Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Lovesang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Introduction. As Dr. Lovesang Rampa lay desperately ill in a Canadian hospital, he looked up with pleasure to see his old friend and mentor, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, standing by his bedside. But it was with some dismay that he listened to the message that the golden figure had brought. Lovesang Rampa's work on this plane was not, as he thought, completed. He had to write another book, his 11th, for there was still more of the mystic truth to be revealed to the world. Here then is that 11th book. Feeding the Flame is mainly concerned with answering some of the questions which Dr. Rampa's readers have put to him over the years. It covers such subjects as life after death, suicide, meditation, and Ouija boards, and includes many invaluable observations on the modern world. Dr. Rampa's many admirers will be delighted that, despite the pain and suffering of his illness, he has been spared to write this fascinating and inspiring book. Feeding the Flame. It saves a lot of letters if I tell you why I have a certain title. It is said, it is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. In my first 10 books, I have tried to light a candle, or possibly two. In this, the 11th book, I'm trying to feed the flame. And a poem by W. A. de Munich of Edmonton, Alberta. The Race of Tan. Copper is this man, a man of daytime white. Yellow is that man, and one of darkest night. The four main colors all known as man, tomorrow's unity will come, forming the Race of Tan. Chapter 1. The More You Know, the More You Have to Learn. The letter was short, sharp, and very much to the point. Sir, it said, why do you waste so much paper in your books? Who likes to read these pretty, pretty descriptions of Tibet? Tell us instead how to win the Irish sweepstake. The second one followed that theme very well. Dear Dr. Rampa, wrote this brash young man, why do you waste so much time writing about the next life? Why not tell us how to make money in this one? I want to know how to make money now. I want to know how to make girls do what I want now. Never mind the next life. I'm still trying to live this one. The old man put down the letter and sat back, shaking his head sadly. I can write only in my own way, he said. I am writing truth, not fiction. So, fog lay heavy on the river. Trailing tendrils swirled and billowed, redolent of sewage and garlic. It swept yellow feelers like a living creature seeking entry to any habitation. From the invisible water came the urgent hoot of a tug, followed by furious yells in the French-Canadian patois. Overhead, a dark red sun struggled to pierce the odorous gloom. The old man, sitting in his wheelchair, peered disgustedly around at the clammy building. Water dripped mournfully from some moldering concrete wall. A vagrant breeze added a new dimension to the world of smells conjured up by the fog. Decaying fish heads. Pah, muttered the old man, what a crummy dump. With that profound thought, he propelled his chair back into the apartment and hastily closed the door. The letter thumped through the letter box. The old man opened it and snorted. "No water tonight," he said. "No heat either." Then, as an afterthought, "And it says that for some hours there'll be no electricity because some pipe or something has burst." "Write another book," said the people on the other side of life. So the old man and family old man went off in search of quiet. Quiet? Blaring radios, rumbling hi-fis, and yowling children shrieking through the place. Quiet. Gaping sightseers peering in through windows, banging on doors, demanding answers to stupid questions. A dump where quiet is not. A pad where nothing is done without immense effort. A pipe leaks. One reports it. Much later, a plumber arrives to see it himself. He reports it to his superior, the building superintendent. He comes to see it before reporting it to the office. The office reports it to his superior. He gets on the telephone. A conference is held, and much later, a decision is reached. Back it comes from Montreal office to the superior, who tells the building superintendent, who tells the plumber, who tells the tenant that next week, if we have time, we will fix it. A crummy dump is how one person described it. The old man had no such delicate way of describing the place. Actions speak louder than words. Long before his tenancy expired, the old man and family left, before they died in such squalid surroundings. With joy, they returned to the city of St. John, and there, because of the strains and stresses in Montreal, the old man's condition rapidly worsened until, very late at night, there was an urgent call for an ambulance and hospital. The gentle snow came sliding down like thoughts falling from the heavens. A light dusting of white gave the illusion of frosting on a Christmas cake. Outside, the stained glass window of the cathedral gleamed through the darkness and shed vivid greens and reds and yellows on the falling snow. Faintly came the sounds of the organ and the sonorous chant of human voices. Louder, from right beneath the window, came the music of a tomcat ardently singing of his love. The hiss of breaking tires on the snow-clad road, the metallic clang of doors slamming, and the shuffle of overshoe-clad feet, a fresh congregation filing in to the evening service, muttered greetings as old friends met and passed, the solitary tolling of a tenor bell exhorting the tardy to hurry, silence save for the muted buzz of distant traffic in the city. Silence, save for the amorous tomcat singing his song, pausing for a reply and commencing all over again. Through a broken pane of the cathedral window, smashed by a teenage vandal, came a glimpse of the robed priest in solemn procession, followed by swaying, jostling choir boys, singing and giggling at the same time. The sound of the organ swelled and diminished. Soon came the drone of a solitary voice intoning ancient prayers, the rumble of the organ, and again a glimpse of robed figures returning to the vestry. Soon there came the sound of many footsteps and the slamming of car doors, the sharp bark as engines coughed into life, the grating of gears and the whirring of wheels as the cathedral traffic moved off for another night. In the great building, lights flicked off one by one, until at last there was only the pale moonlight shining down from a cloudless sky. The snow had ceased, the congregation had gone, and even the anxious tomcat had wandered off on the eternal quest. In the hospital, facing on to the cathedral, the night staff were just coming on duty. At the nurse's station, just facing the elevators, a lone intern was giving last-minute instructions about the treatment of a very sick patient. Nurses were checking their trays of drugs and pills. Sisters were writing up their reports, and a flustered male orderly was explaining that he was late on duty through being stopped for speeding by a policeman. Gradually, the hospital settled down for the night. No breakfast. Signs were fixed on the beds of patients due for operations the next day. Main lights were extinguished, and white-clad attendants moved to a screened bed. Silently, a wheeled stretcher was moved behind the screens. Almost inaudible grunts and muttered instructions, and a still figure, entirely covered by a sheet, was pushed into sight. On whispering wheels, the burden was carefully moved into the corridor. Silent attendants stood by while the summoned elevator slid to a stop. Then, as if controlled by a single thought, the two men moved in unison to propel the laden wheeled stretcher into the elevator and so down to the basement mortuary and the great refrigerator standing like an immense filing cabinet, the repository of so many bodies. The hours dragged by as each reluctant minute seemed loath to give up its brief tenure of life. Here, a patient breathed in stertorous gasps. There, another tossed and moaned in pain. From a side cubicle came the cracked voice of an aged man calling incessantly for his wife. The faint squeak of rubber soles on stone flooring, the rustle of starched cloth, the clink of metal against glasses, and the moaning voice ceased and soon was replaced by snores rising and falling on the night air. Outside, the urgent siren of a fire engine caused many a sleepless patient to wonder briefly where it was before lapsing again into introspection and fear for the future. Through the slightly open window came the raucous sound of a late reveler being heartily sick on the flagstones, a muttered curse as someone shouted at him, and a string of Hail Marys as the alcohol fumes made him retch again. The angel of death went about his merciful mission, bringing ease to a tortured sufferer, ending at last the useless struggle of one ravaged beyond hope by cancer. The stertorous gasp ceased. There was the quick, painless reflex twitch as the soul left a body, and the attendants with their whispered wheeled stretcher moved forward again, and later yet again. He, the last one, was a man noted in politics. On the morrow, the yellow press would dig in their files and come up with the usual inaccuracies and downright lies as ever. In a room looking out over the cathedral close and from whence a sparkling glimpse could be obtained of the sea in Courtney Bay, the old Buddhist lay inert, awake, in pain, thinking of many things, A faint smile flickered on his lips and was as quickly gone at the thought of an incident early in the day. A nun had entered his room, a nun more holy-looking than usual. She looked sadly at the old Buddhist, and a tear glistened in the corner of each eye. Sadly she looked and turned away. "What is the matter, sister?" queried the old Buddhist. "You look very sad." She shrugged her shoulders and exclaimed, "Oh, it is sad. You will go straight to hell." The old Buddhist felt his mouth drop open in amazement. "Go straight to hell?" he said wonderingly. "Why?" "Because you are a Buddhist. Only Catholics go to heaven. Other Christians go to purgatory. Buddhists and other heathens go straight to hell. Oh, and such a nice old man as you, going straight to hell, it is so sad." Hastily she fled the room, leaving an amazed old Buddhist behind to puzzle it out. The angel of death moved on, moved into the room and stood looking down at the old Buddhist. The old man stared back. "Release at last, eh?" he asked. "About time, too. I thought you'd never come." Gently, the angel of death raised his right hand and was about to lay it on the head of the old man. Suddenly, the very air of the room crackled, and a golden figure appeared in the blue gloom of the midnight shadows. The angel stayed his hand at a gesture from the visitor. "No, no, the time is not yet," exclaimed a well-loved voice. "There is more to be done before you come home." The old man sighed. Even the sight of the Lama Mingyar Dondup could not console him for a further prolongation of his stay upon earth, an earth which had treated him so badly through hatred fostered and encouraged by the perverted press. The Lama Mingyar Dondup turned to the old man and explained, "There is yet another book to be written, more knowledge to be passed on, and a little task connected with auras and photography, just a little longer." The old man groaned out loud. "So much always to do, so few to do it, such a chronic shortage of money, and how could one purchase equipment without money?" The Lama Mingyar Dondup stood beside the hospital bed. He and the angel of death looked at each other, and much telepathic information was passed. The angel nodded his head and slowly withdrew and passed on to continue elsewhere the work of mercy, terminating suffering, setting free immortal souls imprisoned in the clay of the flesh body. For a moment in that small hospital room there was no sound. Outside there were the usual night noises, a stray dog prowling around the garbage bins, an ambulance drawing into the emergency entrance of the hospital. Lob sang. The Lama Mingyar Dondup looked down at the old man lying there in pain upon the hospital bed. "Lob Sang," he said, "in your next book, we want you to make it very clear that when you leave this earth, you will not be communicating with any backstreet mediums, nor guiding those who advertise in the cult magazines." "Whatever do you mean, honorable guide?" said the old man. "I'm not cooperating with any mediums or cult magazines. I never read the things myself." "No, Lob Sang, we know you do not, and that's why I'm telling you this. If you had been reading those magazines, we should not have to tell you. But There are certain unscrupulous people who advertise consultative services, etc., and pretend that they are in touch with those who have passed over. They are pretending that they are getting advice and healing and all that from beyond this earth, which, of course, is utterly ridiculous. We want to make it very clear that you are not in any way encouraging that trickery or quackery. The old man sighed with some considerable exasperation and replied, "No, I never read any of those magazines, neither English nor American. I consider they do more harm than good. They accept misleading advertising, and much of it is dangerous, and they have such personal bias and such personal dislike of anyone not in their own little clique that they actually do harm what they pretend they are helping. So I will do as you say. I will make it clear that when I leave this earth, I shall not return." Reader, oh, you most discerning of people, may I have your attention for a moment. In fulfillment of my promise, I want to say this. I, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, do hereby solemnly and irrevocably state that I shall not return to this earth and act as a consultant for anyone who claims that I am so acting. Nor shall I appear at any mediumistic group. I have other work to do. I shall not have time to play about with these things, which I personally dislike. So, reader, if you see any advertisement at any time which purports to imply that such and such a person is in spiritual contact with Lobsang Rampa, call the police. Call the post office authorities. Have the person arrested for fraud, for trying to use the mails, etc., for fraudulent purposes. I, when I have finished with this earth in this life, am moving on a long, long way. So there it is. I have delivered that special message. Back in the green-tinted hospital room, with the window looking out over the cathedral and with its glimpse of the waters of Courtney Bay, the Lama, Mingyur Dondup, was stating what was required. "This, your 11th book," said the Lama, "should give answers to many of the questions you've received, questions which are just and reasonable. You have lit the flame of knowledge, and now in this book you need to feed the flame that it may get a hold on people's minds and spread." He looked grave and quite a bit sorrowful as he went on. "I know you suffer greatly. I know that you will be discharged from this hospital as incurable, as inoperable, and with little time to live, but you still have time to do one or two tasks which have been neglected by others." The old man listened carefully, thinking how unfair it was that some people should have all the health and all the money, they could do anything and get on with their own tasks in the easiest conditions possible, whereas he had suffering, continuous persecution and hatred from the press, and shortage of money. He thought how sad it was that there was no Medicare in this province, and how expensive medical bills were. For some time, the two, the old man and the Lama Mingyur Dondup, talked as old friends will, talked of the past, laughed over many incidents which were not funny at the time they occurred, but were most amusing in retrospect. Then at last there was a shuffling of footsteps as the night orderly went about his duties. The Lama, Mingyur donned up, bade a hasty farewell, and the golden light faded, and the bare hospital room was once again in the blue gloom of early morning. The door was pushed open, and a white-clad orderly just moved in with his flashlight, forming a pool of light around his feet. He listened to the sound of breathing, and then quietly withdrew and went on about his rounds. From across the corridor came the uproar and cries as the aged man incessantly called for his wife. Another voice farther down the corridor broke in with a torrent of Ave Marias, endlessly repeated, monotonously repeated, reminding the old man of some of the almost mindless monks who repeated Om Mani Padme Om incessantly without a thought as to what it actually meant. From somewhere far away, a clock struck the hours. 1, 2, 3. The old man tossed restlessly. The pain was acute, and made more acute by the strain through which he had just gone. On the day before, he had had a total collapse, and even in a hospital, a total collapse is a matter of some concern. 3 o'clock. The night was long. From somewhere out in the Bay of Fundy, a tugboat hooted as it and some others went out to bring in an oil ship waiting to berth by the oil refinery. A shooting star hurtled across the heavens, leaving a glowing trail behind it. From the cathedral tower, an owl hooted, and then, as if suddenly ashamed of the noise he was making, emitted a squawk of fright and flapped off across the city. 4 o'clock, and the night was dark. There was no moon now, but suddenly the shaft of a searchlight wavered across the bay and came to rest on a small fishing boat, which probably was fishing for lobsters. The light snapped off, and into sight came a tug towing a very large oil ship. Slowly they ploughed through the turgid waters of Courtenay Bay. Slowly the bright red light on the port side of the oil ship came into view and moved across the field of vision to be hidden behind the old people's home standing close by. Outside, in the corridor, there was a sudden hushed commotion, whispering voices, the sound of controlled hurry, then a new voice, an intern hurriedly roused from his bed. Yes, an emergency and the need for an immediate operation. Quickly, the orderly on duty and a nurse got the patient onto the wheeled stretcher. Quickly, it was hustled past the doors and down in the elevator to the operating area 2 floors below. For some minutes, there were whispering voices and the rustling of starched clothes. Then, all noise stopped again. 5 o'clock. The old man started. Someone was standing beside him, a white-clad orderly. Brightly, he said, "I just thought I'd tell you there's no breakfast for you this morning, nothing to drink either." Smiling to himself, he turned and walked out of the room. The old man lay there marveling at the crass, idiotic stupidity which made it necessary to awaken a patient who had just gone to sleep. Awaken him that he could be told that there was no breakfast for him. One of the most frustrating things is lying in a hospital bed, hungry and thirsty, and having just outside one's open door an immense contraption stuffed with food, ready prepared breakfast for every patient who could have breakfast on that particular floor. But the old man glanced to his right, and there it was, no breakfast, plain as could be. He stretched out his hand for a drink of water, but no, no, no water either. Nothing to eat, nothing to drink. Others were having their breakfast. There was a clatter of dishes and the noise of trays being dropped and slammed around. Eventually, the turmoil ceased, and the hospital was setting about its ordinary morning business. People to go to the theater, where they wouldn't see a good show either. People to go to the X-ray, people to go to pathology, and the lucky ones to go home. Perhaps the luckiest ones of all were those who had passed over to one's true home. The old man lay back in his bed and thought of the pleasures of passing over. The only difficulty is that, when one is dying, it is usually the physical breakdown of some part. Some portion of one's anatomy has been invaded by a dread disease, for instance, or something is being poisoned. Naturally, that causes pain. But dying itself is painless. There is nothing to fear in dying. As one is about to die, there comes an inner peace. One gets a sense of satisfaction, knowing that at last the long day has ended. Work has ceased. One's task has either been done, or, for the time being, it is being suspended. One has the knowledge that one is going home. Going home to where one's capacities will be assessed and where one's spiritual health will be built up. It's a pleasant sensation, really. One is ill. One is in the last stages. Pain suddenly ceases to be acute, and there is a numbness followed quite speedily by a feeling of well-being, a feeling of euphoria. Then one becomes aware that the physical world is dimming and the astral world is brightening. It is like looking at a TV screen in the darkness. The picture is darkening. There's nothing to distract from the picture on the television screen if everything else is in darkness. That television screen represents the life on Earth. But let the dawn come. Let the rays of the sun come shining in the window to impinge on the television screen, and the brightness of the sun will make the television pictures disappear from our sight. The sunlight represents the astral day. So the physical world, which we term Earth, fades away. People look faint. Their images look faint. They look like shadows. And the colors of the earth disappear, and the earth becomes peopled with gray phantoms. The sky, even on the brightest day, turns purple. And as one's sight on the earth fades, one's sight in the astral brightens. About the deathbed, we see helpers, kind people, those who are going to help us to be reborn into the astral world. We had attention when we were born into this world, which we call Earth, perhaps a doctor, perhaps a midwife, perhaps even a taxi driver, no matter who, it was someone to help. But waiting for us, to deliver us on the other side, are highly experienced people, highly trained people, people who are completely understanding, completely sympathetic. On Earth, we have had a hard time, a shocking time. Earth is hell, you know. We have to go to hell for all sorts of things. A lot of children think school is hell, too. Earth is the school of wayward humans, so we are in a shaken condition, and most people fear death. They fear the pain. They fear the mystery. They fear because they do not know what is going to happen. They fear they're going to face some wrathful God who will stick a hay fork into some part of their anatomy and toss them straight down to old Satan, who will have the branding irons all ready. But that is rubbish. There's no such thing as a wrathful God. If we are to love God, then we have to love a kind and understanding God. Talk of fearing God is nonsense. It is criminal. Why should we fear one who loves us? Do you fear a really kind and understanding father? Do you fear a really kind and understanding mother? Not if you're sane. Then, why fear God? There is a God, very definitely there is a God, a kind God. But back to our deathbed. The body is upon the bed. The sight has just failed. Perhaps the breath is still struggling in the chest. At last that, too, fades, ceases, and becomes no more. There is a twitch, which journalists would probably call a convulsive shudder of agony. It's nothing of the kind. It's painless, or to be more accurate, it's a pleasurable sensation. It's like shrugging out of a cold and clammy suit of clothes and being able to get the warm air and sunlight on one's body. There is this convulsive jerk, and then the astral body soars upward. The feeling is indescribable. Can one imagine what it is like to be swimming in champagne with all the little bubbles bounding against one's body? What is the most pleasurable holiday you have ever had? Have you been on the sands somewhere, just lazing away with the sunlight pouring upon you and the sound of the waves in your ears and a gentle scented breeze ruffling your hair? Well, that's crude. That's nothing compared to the reality. There is nothing which can describe the pure ecstasy of leaving the body and going home. The old man thought of these things, delved back in his memories, and knowing what was and what was to be, the day was past. The day was endured, and would perhaps be a better statement. Soon night came again. In this hospital, there were no visitors. No visitors at all. An epidemic in the whole area had caused all the hospitals to be closed to visitors. So, patients were on their own. Those in public wards could talk to each other. Those who were in rooms alone stayed alone. And it was jolly good for meditation, too. At last, a day or two later, it seemed an eternity. The old man was sent home. Nothing could be done, no cure, no operation, no hope. And so he decided to do as requested by those knowledgeable people on the other side of life and write the 11th book. And it is going to be answering people's questions. For several months past, the old man had been carefully combing the 40 or so letters which arrived every day, and picking out those which had questions which seemed to be of most general interest. He wrote to a number of people in different countries, suggesting that they should do a list of questions they wanted answered, and some very good friends were made. We must not forget our old friend, Mrs. Valerie Sorok, but the old man wants to thank, in particular, these for providing questions which will be answered in this book. Mr. and Miss Newman, Mr. and Mrs. Yeti Thompson, Mr. de Munich, Mrs. Roadhaver, Mrs. Ruby Simmons, Miss Betty Jessie, Mr. Gray Bergen, Mr. and Mrs. Hans Cermak, Mr. James Dodd, Mrs. Peen, Mrs. Van Ash, Mr. John Henderson, Mrs. Lelias Cuthbert, Mr. David O'Connor, and the Worstman ladies. So the old man was sent home. Sent home. Simple little words, probably it means nothing to the average person. But to one who has never had a home until fairly recently, until fairly late in life, it means quite a thing. Sent home. Well, it means being with loved ones, in familiar surroundings, where sorrows are not so great. Sorrows shared are sorrows halved or quartered. So the old man was sent home. Miss Cleopatra and Miss Tadalinka were there with their most serious manners to see what sort of strange creature came back from the hospital. There was much wrinkling of noses and much hard sniffing. Hospital smells are strange smells, and how was it that the old man was still in one piece instead of having lumps cut off? He still had two arms and legs. Of course, he hadn't had a tail, but he didn't have one before. So Miss Cleopatra and Miss Tadalinka inspected him most gravely and then came to a decision. "I know," said Miss Cleopatra. "I know exactly what has happened. He's come back to finish the book, Feeding the Flame, before he is taken off to feed the flame at the local crematorium. That's going to come as sure as eggs is eggs." Miss Tadalinka looked very grave indeed. "Yes," she said, "but if he loses any more weight, there won't be anything with which to feed the flames. I think they must have starved him. I wonder if we should give him some of our food." Miss Cleopatra jumped on the old man's chest and sniffed around, sniffed his beard, sniffed his ears, and had a good sniff of his mouth. "I think he's underfed, Tad," she said. "I think we shall have to have a word with Ma to get him stuffed up with a bit of food to fill out all those hollows." But no matter what Miss Cleopatra said, no matter what Miss Tadalinka said, and no matter how good Ma's intentions, the old man was on a diet for the rest of his life, a miserable, horrifying diet, hardly enough to keep body and soul together. Miss Tadalinka rushed under the bed to Miss Cleopatra. "Say, Clee," she yelled, "you know something? I've just heard them talking. He's losing a pound a day. So that means that in 270 days, he won't weigh anything at all." Both cats sat there thinking about it, and then Miss Cleopatra nodded her head very wisely, and with all the wisdom and sagacity which comes to a little girl cat 4 years old. "Ah, yes," she exclaimed, "but you've forgotten one thing, Taddy. The hungrier he is, the sicker he is, the more clairvoyant he becomes. Soon he'll be seeing things before it happens." "Fooey to that," said Miss Tadalinka. "He does already. Look at the telepathic messages he sent us from the hospital. Still, it's good preparation for the start of his book. I think we'd better help him all we can." The radiator was quite warm, and both little cats jumped up on the sill above the radiators, and there they stretched out full length, head to tail, and went into the usual state of introspection before communicating all the thoughts of the day to the local cats. The old man? Well, The old man was glad to get in bed. He lay back for a time and thought, "This wretched book. Suppose I have to write it. I have to live, and even if I don't eat much nowadays, I have to pay for what I do eat." So, on the morrow, he decided, "Let's start this book with the hope that it would be finished." And here it is. It started, and you are reading the first chapter, aren't you? Quite a lot of people have written asking things, asking all manner of questions. Well, it would be a good idea if this book were devoted to answering what appear to be common questions. People have a right to know. Otherwise, they get weird ideas, such as those who think that death is a terrible thing, such as those who think there is no afterlife. Well, it always amuses me when people say there is no afterlife just because they don't know about it. In the same way, a person living in a remote country can say, "There is no London, there is no New York, no Buenos Aires," because they haven't actually seen it. After all, pictures can be faked. I've seen a lot of faked pictures about life on the other side, and that is quite a pity. There is a very, very good other side, and it is the depth of absurdity when crooks and perverted seers produce a lot of faked stuff. It's so easy to produce the actual reality. Easier, in fact. I had hoped to get on with the aura research. Unfortunately, I've had to leave that through lack of money, and now, well, there's no medical health scheme here, not like in England, and everything is frightfully expensive, so the aura work will have to be left for others. There's another project which I wanted to develop, and it is this. It is absolutely possible to make a device which will enable one to telephone the astral world. It has actually been done, but the man who did it had such a barrage of doubts, suspicions, and accusations from the press that he got tired of it. He lost heart, and driven by the insane press, he smashed his apparatus and committed suicide. It is quite possible to make a telephone with which to telephone the astral world. Consider speech now. When we speak, we cause a vibration which imparts its energy to columns of air, which in turn energizes some receiving apparatus, for example, someone's ear, and so they hear the sounds we make. It is interpreted as speech. No one has ever yet succeeded in standing atop a radio mast and shouting to the world and being heard all over the world. For that, the vibrations are transformed into a different form of energy, and messages spoken and transformed into this energy can be heard with suitable apparatus all over the world. I listen to England, Japan, Australia, Germany, everywhere. I have even heard Little America in the South Antarctic. A device to telephone the astral is something like that. It transforms present-day radio waves into something incomparably higher, just as radio waves in turn are very much higher in frequency than is speech. In days to come, people will be able to telephone those who have newly passed over in much the same way as a person can now telephone a hospital and, if he's lucky and the nurse is feeling good-tempered, can speak to a patient who's recovering from an operation. And so it will be that those who have newly passed over and are recuperating from the strain of passing over, just as a mother and her baby recuperate from birth strains, so while this recuperation process is taking place, relatives can telephone a reception area and find out how the patient is doing. Naturally, when the patient is quite recovered and has gone to yet another dimension, he or she will be too busy to be bothered by the petty little affairs of this earth. This earth is just a speck of dust existing for the twinkle of an eye in what is the real time. For those who are interested, I have actually seen such a telephone and actually seen it in use. It's a pity that the idiot press is not subject to censorship, because they should not be permitted to take foolish actions just for the sake of sensation and so inhibit what are real developments. So now, let us consider this as a start and the ending of the first chapter. We'll go on together and see what we can do to answer some questions in the second. End of chapter 1.